From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, guns don't kill people, screenwriters do. We listen to a panel of screenwriters reflecting on what impact, if any, they think their work has on provoking teen violence. The discussion was recorded earlier this month at a Writers Guild conference in Los Angeles. Then, the story of one of the most ridiculed foods of our century, Spam. We talk with Carolyn Wyman about her new biography of the infamous canned meat, which, by the way, she loves. She also writes a syndicated newspaper column about processed foods, which are about the only foods she eats. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. While ethnic Albanians are being bussed back to their homes in Kosovo by the United Nations, many Serbs are concerned about reprisal attacks. A leading member of the Serbian Orthodox Church has called on the international community to provide more protection for the Serbs. NPR's Andy Bowers is in Pristina.
The Serbian Orthodox Bishop of Kosovo said today that if Serbs feel the continuing need to flee the province and there are continued acts of violence against them, that ethnic cleansing will in fact have taken place in Kosovo, but instead of Albanians, it will have been the Serbs who have left. And the leadership of the Serbian Orthodox Church has sent an urgent letter to NATO and to the United Nations demanding better protection from NATO for Serbs who decide to remain in Kosovo, and demanding also that war crimes investigators look at alleged acts of atrocity by Albanians as well as Serbs.
NPR's Andy Bowers in Pristina. President Clinton said today that he's ready to intervene personally again in an effort to salvage the Northern Ireland peace accord. The president spoke as British Prime Minister Tony Blair and Irish Prime Minister Bertie Ahern try to bring Northern Irish Protestants and Catholics together to form a central government. Protestant leaders have stalled the agreement by refusing to allow the Sinn Féin party to be part of the government until its allied Irish Republican Army begins to give up its weapons. President Clinton said Protestant leaders should accept Sinn Féin into the cabinet if it promises to bring about the IRA's disarmament. He noted that the Protestant parties can always walk away from the agreement if the Sinn Féin commitments aren't met. Authorities in Northern Ireland have refused permission for Protestant marchers to take their parade through hostile Catholic areas. NPR's Philip Davis reports from London.
The Protestant Drumcree Orange Order, as they do every year, applied to march through the town of Portadown, including through the predominantly Catholic enclave of Drumcree. The march often turns into a confrontation and then escalates into riots. This year, though, authorities banned the marchers from going through those areas. Their action comes as British and Irish leaders are in Belfast talking with Republican and Unionist factions in Northern Ireland in a desperate attempt to save last year's Good Friday peace agreement, which many had hoped would bring an end to sectarian violence. The accord is foundering over a dispute over how paramilitary organizations like the Irish Republican Army will be disarmed. So far, the talks have not yielded a breakthrough. Philip Davis, NPR News, London.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 103 points to close at 10,655. Advances led declines by nearly 2-1 in light trading of 641 million shares. This is NPR News. President Clinton said today that he'd consider using some of the growing budget surplus for bigger tax cuts, but he said Social Security and Medicare must be preserved first. The White House has released a new budget projection showing that budget surpluses would be a total of $1 trillion higher over the next 15 years than previously thought. The president's plan sticks to the targeted tax cuts he proposed earlier this year, but Republicans say they want far bigger tax cuts while still protecting Social Security. A precedent-setting tobacco liability case is now in the hands of a Miami jury. Individuals have sued tobacco companies before, but this is the first class action suit. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports from Miami.
The six-member jury and alternates were selected almost a year ago. Since October, they've been listening to testimony and reviewing tobacco industry documents. Starting today, the jury must answer 12 pages of detailed questions to determine whether the industry is liable for the illnesses of a potential 500,000 Florida smokers represented in this case. The lawyers representing the class of smokers say the tobacco industry hooked people on nicotine, a drug as powerful as cocaine or heroin and just as hard to quit. The industry's attorneys, while declining to say that smoking causes cancer and other diseases, assert that smokers knew their habit was a risky one and could have chosen to quit. The current and former smokers are seeking $200 billion in damages from the tobacco industry. Cheryl Duvall, NPR News, Miami.
The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 46 points today to close at 2,599. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the wake of the recent school shootings, pop culture is being blamed by many politicians for inciting violence. President Clinton has initiated a study of whether the movie, video game, and music industries are deliberately marketing violence to kids. And the House passed an amendment to the Juvenile Justice Crime Bill stating that no industry does more to glorify gun violence than some elements of the motion picture industry. The movie industry has been trying to figure out how to respond. Earlier this month, screenwriters reflected on their role and responsibilities in a panel discussion titled Guns Don't Kill People, Writers Do. It was part of a conference held by the Writers Guild Foundation in Los Angeles. We're going to hear excerpts of this discussion, featuring comments by Callie Khoury, who wrote Thelma and Louise, Stephen D'Souza, who wrote Die Hard, Die Hard 2, and 48 Hours, Brian Helgeland, who wrote L.A. Confidential, Miguel Tejada Flores, who wrote Revenge of the Nerds and co-wrote Fright Night 2, and Jack Valenti, president of the Motion Picture Association of America, the group responsible for rating movies. The moderator was Daniel Petrie, Jr., whose credits include Beverly Hills Cop and The Big Easy. We'll start with William Mastro Simone, who wrote the TV movies Extremities and The Burning Season, talking about an article he wrote for the Guild magazine in an issue about Hollywood and violence.
I would say my core belief as a screenwriter is the cinema is the campfire around which young people gather in the global village to learn the ways of the tribe. And I think that when something goes on the screen, it takes on a greater importance. It becomes mythic and heroic. And that being true, it taps into a different part of the psyche than just news on television or a novel or any other form of artistic expression. And the part of the unconscious is the core of our being. And I think the part that changes our behavior, that governs our behavior. And I think that one proof of this is tyrants throughout history have known this. I mean, it's no accident that Stalin closed the theaters and made cinema part of his power apparatus. Because he knew it's not just entertainment, it's not just fantasy. What it is a direct pipeline to the unconscious mind.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to pick up on your point about it being a global village, because I think it is, and cinema has an immense reach. American cinema has an immense reach all over the world. When we look at what happened in Littleton and look about Hollywood, the potential for Hollywood to have influenced or created an atmosphere that creates such an event, we have to look, I think, also to Japan and Britain, where the same movies are played and the same response is not elicited. Is that a valid
I think the big thing there is gun control laws in those countries.
Is that the distinction?
I think it's one of the main distinctions. There's a couple. There was an interesting book published about 2 years ago on this very topic, and it was called The Samurai, the Mountie, and the Cowboy. I forget the author's name. And it was a comparison of media, violence, all these elements in three countries that have a historical tradition that is rooted in violence, taming a wilderness, and all of these things. It's worth noting that Canada watches exactly the same television we're watching here. They get all the same movies. They play the same video games. And in Canada, by the way, going back to the same frontier tradition they have in common with us, you know, any responsible adult can buy a rifle or a shotgun. However, it is almost impossible to get one of these assault weapons, and it's extremely difficult to get a handgun. In Japan, where the movies that they make there and the comic books and video games they make there are even more violent and twisted than what we have here. The most popular comic book in Japan is called Rape Man. I'm not making this up. We have Superman, Batman. They have Rape Man, about a guy who has one particular bionic appendage. And in between crime fighting, he services women who are happy to have had their brief encounter with Rape Man. But meanwhile, they do not have the violence level that we do here. So one of the other things you brought about the global village is very important. You talked about how the first thing that the tyrants do is they seize the media. And you're absolutely right that Stalin and around the same time Goebbels seize control of the media. But what's real interesting about that pipeline into the brains of the masses is they didn't make violent stuff. The Soviet films don't show people with machine guns going in blowing people away. They show the love of a boy in his tractor. The Nazi films, I brought an example of Nazi propaganda here, actually. I thought it would come up. This is a book called Signal. It was a magazine they published in Nazi Germany. It was almost, a lot of it influenced Life magazine. And they published it in English under the hope that one day they were going to, like, conquer the world. So, like, here's, like, an article from Signal. It's kind of a Disney-like cartoon about you and your party, how you fit in, how, like, the party takes Pear Grandma. Here's a Hitler youth rally up here in the corner. But, like, nowhere do they show a concentration camp here. Nowhere does it say let's round up the Jews and Gypsies. So here you had the most wholesome, policed, upstanding media you can imagine. Their radio, their books, their television. They didn't have television. And meanwhile, offstage, outside of the media, is like the most mechanized bloodbath in history. So I think that at the end of the day, the guy or the girl who's got a pencil in their hand, which is supposed to be muddier than the sword, remember all that? To now find ourselves accused of wielding swords. This is the first time I've ever volunteered to come and be a scapegoat, I think, you know. And I have to say one more thing. If this panel were not disingenuous, it would not be called Writers Don't... What's our title? Guns Don't Kill People, Writers Kill People. It would be Guns Don't Kill People, Studios Kill People. Because every writer up here may remember that when they signed their contracts, there was one little piece of paper that says, for all intents and purposes regarding worldwide copyright, the studio is the author. Now, I'll tell you right now, you take that piece of paper away, you don't make me sign that, you let me keep copyright, and I'll get in line, I'll say, you can sue me along with everybody else at Littleton. Get me in line. I'll be, you know, because when I write something, I'll tell you, every picture I have done has come out more violent than what I wrote. I have sat at the screening, and they're supposed to show it to you while they're cutting it. How many people here, I mean, except when you get involved in directing, they never do. I have sat at the screening of one of my movies and been stunned at the level of mayhem that somebody put on screen. So now do I feel guilty? Who do I take this up with? Was it the stunt guy? Was it the guy with the prosthetics? You know, it's a very fuzzy arena. All I know is the studio maybe signed a paper every time. I'm not the author, even though my name is on the screenplay.
You made a number of points. I'm going to come back.
We're listening to a panel discussion about guns, violence, and the movies, recorded at a Writers Guild Foundation conference earlier this month in Los Angeles. We just heard comments from Stephen D'Souza, who wrote a couple of the Die Hard movies. After his comments, moderator Daniel Petrie Jr. posed a question to Callie Corey, who wrote Thelma and Louise.
Callie, where do you...
Where do I come down on all this?
How do you, you know, there's personal responsibility, artistic responsibility, responsibility to the culture.
Well, it's very difficult to make the argument that you're only responsible to yourself, because we know that what we do has an impact. We know that we do affect the culture. I think a lot of what we're dealing with is we're seeing a society that's totally out of balance, and I think a lot of that is because of a free market attitude that if they'll eat shit, that's a lot easier to make than something good. And so let's just feed them that. Now, I feel also that living in a country that is, you know, more organized at protecting its Second Amendment right than its first is in trouble. And that's what's happening here. And I feel that I don't want to be censored. Obviously, it would be impossible for me to sit here and say, well, I wrote a movie, it didn't have any effect whatsoever. If somebody came in and said, well, I know women that shot somebody because they saw that movie, that is where I would draw the line, because I was not saying you should shoot somebody. And in fact, when I first viewed my own movie, Thelma and Louise, with an audience, and the shooting occurred, the audience cheered, and I was stunned, because I had expected a completely different reaction. I had hoped for a completely different reaction. I had hoped for a stunned reaction from the audience, a realization that this character had just sealed her fate in a very horrible way. But instead, they burst into applause. And I was terrified. And I realized I can't control how my work is perceived, that people are going to bring to it whatever it is that they come from. You know, people read Catcher in the Rye and shoot John Lennon. It doesn't make sense. There's always going to be somebody who's going to misinterpret something. On the other hand, when kids are at their most impressionable age, 14-year-old boys, 13-year-old boys, they're left alone, they're not parentally supervised, they are marketed to, and let's face it, we know that they are. We know that that they are the biggest, most likely consumers of particular types of violence, and there's nothing to counterbalance that, then there may be an effect of that. Is that the responsibility of that person who wrote it? I don't know. I would certainly hate to see Steve D'Souza have to go to jail because he wrote a movie and somebody took it wrong. You know, somebody acted out and thought it was an instruction manual. I don't think that's what anybody's here is doing. And I also think that the idea that Hollywood is in some kind of, you know, collusion to try to, you know, violence or desensitize our kids is insane. That's not what's happening. So I don't think that there's an answer here. I think we could talk about this all day long. And we're never going to find out if there's a cause and effect.
That's Callie Khoury, who wrote the screenplay for Thelma and Louise. We're listening to excerpts from a panel discussion recorded earlier this month at the Writers Guild Foundation conference, Words into Pictures. We'll hear more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to excerpts from a panel discussion titled Guns Don't Kill People, Writers Do, which was recorded earlier this month at the Writers Guild Foundation Conference in Los Angeles. The screenwriters were responding to pressure from Washington to cut down on movie violence. Moderator Daniel Petrie Jr. turned to Jack Valenti, president of the Motion Picture Association of America.
Jack, you just got back from Washington earlier this month. You were testifying before the Senate Commerce Committee on this issue. Can you tell us about the kind of comments that you received from senators and give us any insight into what's going on in Washington?
Well, I've been very fortunate in my life, been able to spend all of my adult career in two of life's classic fascinations, movies and politics. And if I've learned one thing in the movie business and in the world of politics, it is that the First Amendment is the one clause in the Constitution that guarantees all others, believe me. And it's not easy to be a First Amendment person, because then you have to allow into this marketplace that which you believe to be soiling and meretricious and tawdry and unwholesome and sometimes vile. And then sometimes people get so vexed they want to call their congressman and say, pass a law and stop all this stuff. But I always say to this person, be wary and be cautious. Before you make that call, remember this, that when a tyrant first appears, he always comes as your protector. In Washington, there are a lot of people who believe that they are the guardians and the repository of all truth and wisdom. And whenever I meet one of these guardians of truth, and God, I've met more of them than I care to enumerate, I have an old Texas prayer that I give. It goes like this. Dear Lord, let me seek the truth, but spare me the company of those who have found it. Now, first, let me talk about perception. The perception is that we are a society going to hell in a handbasket. We've indicted the entire society of teenagers as being aberrant killers who kill wantonly. Somewhere there's a mental disconnect swarming with dark and primitive transactions. And we believe this. The fact is there are 70 million teenagers in this country today. And I'm quoting you now FBI statistics. Only 41 one-hundredths of 1% of all teenagers have ever been arrested for violent crime, and it doesn't mean they were convicted. That means that 99.59% of all the young people in this country have never been involved in a serious crime. The crime rate in this country has been going down steadily for 8 years. Since 1994, juvenile crime has been rapidly descending. You know the safest place for young people in this country? Schoolyards. But the perceptions and the contradictions overwhelm each other. And that's happening in Washington today. And that brings me finally to responsibility. I believe that movies do have some impact. But unlike so many of my friends in Congress, I don't know how much. I don't know if the connecting link, you see a movie and then you go out and get a tech, a DC-9 and blow somebody's head off. All the research, and God knows I've read them until my eyes are bleary, have never made that connecting link. But movies are powerful. They must have some impact. Last year, 686 movies were made in this country, produced in the United States. We don't have enough creative talent, unfortunately, to produce 686 good movies. But I never indict a picture by name. I've never made a picture. And therefore, I am immensely respectful of those who have. And I want to make sure that those 45 words of the First Amendment never are vanquished, because I promise you, if you think we got bad times now, you just don't know without that. Now, when somebody says, what's Hollywood going to do? There is no Hollywood. The Hollywood people talk about died and was interred in Forest Lawn Cemetery in the mid-1950s. When the Justice Department forced the sale of theaters from ownership by studios. But each personal perspective has to be looked at by writers, directors, and actors, and producers and studios themselves. And so if Congress is looking to me to come with them with a plan that all of a sudden is going to correct all this, I don't have one. I'm going to come forward with some positive steps. But you know why it would never work? Because what is violent to Senator Lieberman, to the extreme, may be to somebody else something that is part of this story and is not gratuitous at all. And even though I'm rather enchanted with what I'm saying, I think maybe I ought to.
That was Jack Valenti, president of the Motion Picture Association, recorded at a conference held by the Writers Guild of America earlier this month. His remarks prompted the following comments from panelist Miguel Tejada Flores, who wrote Revenge of the Nerds.
I have a slightly different perspective from my esteemed colleagues here because I used to live in Los Angeles for most of my life, and 10 years ago I moved to a small town in Oregon, and it took me a while to discover that life does not, as many of my, as perhaps I often thought myself when I was younger, revolve around what I do and what the motion picture and entertainment industry does. And that there are a lot of small towns and places where people really don't give a darn what's coming out of Hollywood, but they have their own lives and problems and issues, and they really are not as obsessed with what it is that we're doing. Now,
but they get the trades, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you
I
bet.
Mean, they must.
On the internet.
Okay.
There are a lot of people in state I'm living in now, Oregon, who are poor and dispossessed and lost their jobs and aren't doing so well, and you live in some of these towns and things are a little bit different. And people are not all happy, and some of the people are pretty angry about a lot of things. They care a lot about their guns. They care a lot about their guns. There was a bumper sticker I saw on an older vehicle, because there's a lot of older vehicles around in a town near where I live, and it said, "My idea of gun control is use both hands." And I kind of laughed, and part of me didn't think it was too funny. But there is a acceptance in a lot of places, which people who live in Los Angeles and don't have that perspective, that guns and what guns represent in many ways are an accepted part of what we do. And I think probably if we, I'm not as in command of statistics as some of these gentlemen here, but I will guess that apart from the recent and horrifying tragedies where one or two individuals who used high-powered machine automatic weapons capable of killing a lot of people real fast, which obviously captures our attention and shocks us, I would take a real guess that probably if we look over maybe the last quarter century of our life, we will find a lot of instances where a lot of poor and dispossessed and maybe young people used single-shot weapons to kill a lot of people, and that there was a lot of violence around that. And my perspective on the violence is that it comes from people's sense of powerlessness. Callie was saying that she was shocked when the people cheered when that gun was fired in the movie you wrote. And I think it was kind of shocking, and also there was a sense, for me, there was a feeling of justice being done, and it twisted me, but there was a sense that someone who didn't have power in her life was taking power. So, you know, we can't solve the problem, all of us, of why there are so many unhappy and powerless people in general and young people in particular, but, you know, it's a real toss-up. Do we as artists try and create stuff we feel true to? And at the same time, when you look at people killing each other, are we responsible for that? I don't know.
That was Miguel Tejada Flores, who wrote Revenge of the Nerds, recorded at a conference of screenwriters held earlier this month by the Writers Guild Foundation in Los Angeles. We'll hear more of the panel discussion in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we hear more of the panel of screenwriters discussing violence in the movies. Then America's most infamous mystery meat, we talk with Carolyn Wyman, author of Spam, a biography. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Are the men and women who write movies that portray violence responsible for inciting real violence? Today we're listening to a panel discussion of screenwriters recorded earlier this month at a conference sponsored by the Writers Guild of America. In this final section, we'll hear comments by Callie Corey, who wrote Thelma and Louise, Stephen D'Souza, who wrote Die Hard, Die Hard 2, and 48 Hours, Brian Helgeland, who wrote L.A. Confidential, and Jack Valenti, president of the Motion Picture Association of America, the group responsible for rating movies. We'll pick up with moderator Daniel Petrie Jr., who wrote Beverly Hills Cop and The Big Easy, with the first of a series of questions that had been submitted by the audience.
In nearly every movie or TV show, someone has a gun. What is our cultural fascination with the gun? One asks, but by contrast...
I doubt that is factually correct, but it's still a valid question.
I think that the part of the reason that there's so many guns, and I had to deal with this myself because after I wrote Thelma and Louise, I then, as a challenge to myself, decided to try to write a movie that didn't use a gun. And it's harder. That's why there's so many, because when you tell a story that's totally character and plot driven and you don't have this little instrument that you can take out and change the course of everything, it's more difficult. And in some ways...
Also, I would say that as far as just entertainment, life and death situations are very entertaining. It's suspense and seeing it, and it helps to have a gun a lot of the times to pull
but
that
also,
out.
But also, I think there's, you know, the function of story oftentimes, and what you would hope and what I think most of us hope is that, you know, there's a difference between a vicarious thrill and an actual thrill. I mean, there is the idea out there that some of that acting out that you see on screen is in lieu of you doing it yourself. It's not, you know, it is saying, I feel like that. People are relating to it. Everybody knows that feeling, or has said, if I'd had a gun in my hand, I'd have killed him, you know, because you know what the intensity of that feeling is. And seeing that acted out sometimes is a very satisfying thing. And listen, I go see Terminator movies and things like that, and I'm as happy and thrilled and excited by it as anybody else. I don't think that there's necessarily, you know, just an innate evil in viewing that kind of stuff, you know?
Some comments that I want to get to. Are nonviolent, quote, perfect, unquote, ideal Hollywood films and happy family TV shows as much responsible for clicking something over in someone's mind, which causes these violent tragedies, in that the discrepancy between on-screen fiction is so vast and different to reality?
That's a very valid point, because if Friends is one of the top TV shows, shouldn't people in America become more friendly? Because if we influence them.
And then finally, I hope everybody's saving up points in response. How do you think race figures in this debate? Do you think that there is a heightened interest in the issue of violence by the government because the violence we're talking about is now white middle-class kids killing white middle-class kids, as opposed to the violence playing out earlier in this decade when it was poor black kids killing poor black kids? I guess this also has to do with the power structure in both government and Hollywood.
Jack, you had a comment to one of the earlier points.
You'll be delighted to know that I hope this is my final comment today. One of the suggestions I made in my Senate testimony, and I'm pleased to say two United States senators who don't believe they have all the answers are taking this idea to the Secretary of Education. I grew up Catholic in Houston, Texas, so I know about gun culture, all about it. And one of my first communion was made under the Jesuits. The Jesuit had this marvelous belief, give me the child until he's seven, then you can have him. Because it bespeaks what educators, psychologists, child behavioral experts, and now medical science has all said, that by the time the kid is 7 or 8 years old, all of the support systems that will allow him to conduct himself in a beneficent way through life have already been formed. And I suggested that a new course be funded by the Department of Education, a syllabus sent out to all school superintendents to decide whether they wanted to include it in preschool, in kindergarten, and in grades 1 through 5. My tentative title, which is subject to revision when they bring in the next writer to work on the script, is What is Right and What is Plainly Wrong? And for 30 minutes every day, you teach these kids about what William Faulkner called the old verities, pity and pride and compassion and sacrifice and duty and honor and service, and the cleansing precept of treating others as you would want to be treated yourself. And I'm hopeful that that course with these two senators moving on it will prove to be one tiny step in a generational change, even though all the statistics say this may be one of the safest times in America's history.
Here's a comment. I'm a family therapist, and I have recently worked with a young man who idolizes movie heroes who destroy and kill others. What do you think, as a writer, is your response to this young man who says, if he can do it and it's popular, why can't I?
Well, you look at me, I'll answer that question. I would say, okay, maybe I sound like I'm an apologist for films I do, but there's a certain kind of movie I haven't done. I've actually turned down work, which is the movie about the lone vigilante, about the civilian who takes the law in his own hands. I've turned down that job. All the movies I've done, which have a
lot.
No, no. all the movies I've done have had their hero as either a police officer or a military officer or a soldier with an assignment, with a mission. A so-called franchised hero, the society has picked and said, yes, you can take extreme measures. So I could say to this therapist, well, I haven't made a movie that showed somebody who couldn't wait to roll up his sleeves and go out and kill people. In fact, the Die Hard movies were distinguished by the fact that this law officer, who was authorized to carry a weapon, doesn't want to do it, wants to get help, doesn't want to get into the killing and maiming, and is not looking forward to it. But I have to remember a quote from the late, great mayor of New York, gentleman Jimmy Walker, who said probably 70 years ago, no girl was ever ruined by a book. And I think we have to say that no teenager was ruined by a book. Now, again, I brought from my library here. This is a book I've had for 20 years, The Anarchist Cookbook. Okay? Now, I bought this book not to learn how to make pipe bombs. And by the way, this material is what the kids made the pipe bombs from. This is on the web now. But the courts have said that the web is treated just like print, First Amendment. Now, I got this so I could write authoritatively about people who are making pipe bombs or committing a crime. But I have a First Amendment right to have this book. And I also have a Second Amendment right for the person who wrote the code that if you come to my house to take this book away from me, that I can blow you away with the gun I bought after getting fingerprinted and tested for safety and being checked that I wasn't a mental patient. And I still think that one of the biggest problems is not gun ownership. I own a gun, legally, but the proliferation. And if you do the math on the guns that are manufactured and sold, there aren't enough gun dealers to handle them. So I think back to other people who have been faced with this problem. Gee, are you responsible for what happened? I remember James M. Barry, the author of Peter Pan, who was institutionalized for a month when the first little boy jumped out of a window trying to fly. And he learned about that. I remember Alfred Hitchcock, who carried for, it's in the anecdote in the Truffaut Hitchcock book, he carried in his pocket, laminated, an article about a boy who took his girl to the movies and then strangled her. The movie, Snow White, which Hitchcock would always point out when anybody questioned him about his pictures. I think that we need to, and as far as the video games go, anybody here from who is who's older than video games, let's say from like 35 on to 70, remembers you could go to an arcade before they had video games, and they had a gun, and you could shoot people. It was cowboys, but there were bad guys that you were allowed to shoot. The fact that technology has taken that single-person shooter game, you know, to the home, and you don't have to drop a dime in it, doesn't change the fact that it's a state-of-the-art opportunity for teenagers to practice being, we hope, the good guy. The archetypical American hero is a statue in Boston of a guy with a rifle, the Minuteman. He was ready in a minute to defend liberty, and he's got a gun. We are stuck with those two ideas, the First and Second Amendment. We got to take all 10 of those, and we have to handle them, and we have to realize that Those guys knew that the founders, that things are going to change. They knew the world would move on, which is why they are so brilliantly and cleverly written. It's up to us to interpret them and to carry them on.
Sorry, we're out of time. This is like been extremely provocative. Thank you. I'm sorry I couldn't get to more questions.
We've been listening to excerpts of a panel discussion of screenwriters talking about violence in movies. It was recorded earlier this month at a conference held by the Writers Guild Foundation in Los Angeles. We'd like to thank all the panelists, the Writers Guild Foundation, Dennis Davidson Associates, and Sound Images, which recorded the proceedings. Tapes of this and all the sessions from the conference are available through the conference's website, www.wordsintopictures.org. The Fresh Air broadcast of the panel was produced by Naomi Person with Anne-Marie Baldonado. Coming up, spam. This is Fresh Air. Spam, one of the most ridiculed foods of our century, has been honored with its own biography. The author, Carolyn Wyman, was raised on Spam sandwiches and casseroles and still loves it. Wyman writes a syndicated newspaper column reviewing new processed foods. Spam was invented in 1937 and, as one of the first canned meats, became a staple for soldiers and many civilians during World War II. Here's Monty Python's tribute to Spam.
Morning.
Morning.
Well, what you got?
Well, there's egg and bacon, egg, sausage and bacon, egg and spam, egg, bacon and spam, egg, bacon, sausage and spam, spam, bacon, sausage and spam, spam, egg, spam, spam, bacon and spam, spam, sausage, spam, 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 bacon, spam, tomato and spam, 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 egg and spam, 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 bacon, spam, 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 lobster thermidor crevettes with a Bolognese sauce served in the Provençal manner with shallots and aubergines garnished with truffle pate, brandy and a fried egg on top and spam.
Have you got anything without spam?
Well, the spam egg, sausage and spam. That's not got much spam in it.
I don't want any spam.
Why can't she have egg, bacon, spam and sausage?
That's got spam in it.
Hasn't got as much spam in it as spam, egg, sausage and spam, has it?
Could you do me egg, bacon, spam and sausage without the spam, then?
Yeah!
What do you mean, yeah? I don't like spam.
Spam, 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 spam.
Carolyn Wyman, welcome to Fresh Air. I'm not going to assume that all of our listeners have actually had the pleasure of eating spam. So why don't you describe what it is and what it tastes like?
Well, it's a canned meat product. It tastes very kind of salty, porky, mushy, fatty, delicious to me. It's not made from anything as scary as people think. A lot of people think, you know, there's like pig noses and, you know, brains in there and stuff, and actually all it is pork shoulder with a little bit of ham and some salt and sugar. And the name, you know, spam, comes from spiced ham, although, you know, you look at, well, there's sugar and there's salt, that doesn't seem like really spicy to us, but it is a Midwestern product.
Spam's glory days were during World War II. How did spam become part of the rations for many American soldiers?
Well, it was one of the first things that the government bought to feed soldiers. It was one of only 10 meat products bought initially, as opposed to one of 60 later. So they bought a whole bunch of it, like 150 million pounds for the Army alone. It was because it was affordable and it was shelf-stable and it was filling and was considered nutritious because, you know, it did supply energy, which, you know, people need when they're out doing physical work. The problem was, of course, that they had too much of it, really. And because of, like, oversupply and problems, you know, with distribution, some guys ended up eating it, you know, 1, 2, 3 times a day. And, you know, you couldn't, like, man a be a chef in the military at the time without having a real arsenal of great, you know, spam recipes.
Your father was a World War II veteran. Did he eat a lot of spam?
Yeah, he did. And at least, you know, a lot of guys, I guess, you know, I heard stories about families where after they ate it in the war, they hated it so much. Like, there was one guy that told me when his parents were having a fight, his mother always served spam because, you know, to get back at his father. But in my case, I mean, and in probably the majority of the cases, it became a taste that the soldiers couldn't shake, and spam sales actually went up after the war.
Did your mother cook with spam after the war?
Oh, yeah. I mean, our favorite recipe, our family recipe for spam, I put in the book. It's spam, baked beans, and pineapple casserole. And it's delicious. I mean, the three things just go together really well. It requires no cooking ability beyond, you know, the ability to open a can. And, you know, it's part of my childhood. It's a real kind of a nostalgia trip. I continue to make it, although, you know, now there's only two people in my family, and my husband won't eat spam. So I have to make it and then sort of split it up in little dishes and freeze it. I sort of make my own TV dinners out of it.
You'll excuse me for saying it. Spam, baked beans, and pineapple really sounds horrible.
No, not really. I mean, you got the hamminess and kind of the saltiness of the ham, and then you've got the baked beans, which kind of provide kind of a meaty ballast, and then the pineapple is sweet, and it's just a perfect combination of, you know, flavors and textures as far as I'm concerned.
Well, maybe it's helped by the freezing. how was spam invented? And this is a food that was invented.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, at the time when spam was invented, you know, most meat was sold fresh or cured. It was not sold for the most part in supermarkets. It was still sold by butchers. And, you know, so the idea of selling a canned meat product that would be shelf-stable was kind of bizarre. And Jay Hormel, who was the son of the founder of the Hormel Meat Company, basically saw the problem of there was all this pork shoulder hanging around. I mean, they were making lots of pork and ham products, but pork shoulder is a very bony thing, and it's hard to... It wasn't making them any money at all. They were practically giving it away. And they needed some way in which to make this meat more valuable. And so he, you know, cut it off the bone, you know, mixed it up with some spices, put it in the can, you know, gave it a name and just marketed the heck out of it.
Does spam still sell well?
Yeah, it does. I mean, you know, it doesn't sell as well as it did, you know, post-war and, you know, in the 40s and 50s. But, I mean, they sell 90 million cans of it a year. And it's particularly popular in the South. Families, people with kids, and, you know, older people.
What are some of the oddest spam recipes you came across in putting together your book?
Well, there is a spam bread that's sort of similar to like a banana bread. It has apples and a lot of spices in it. And you can really hardly taste the spam in it when you eat it. It's more, it sort of functions more like shortening. But, it, you know, it kind of is, it wows them if you tell them that, you know, it's a spam bread. There's also a number of many spam cheesecakes out there, although they're savory style. There's been, see, Hormel since around 92 has, or 91, they've sponsored cooking contests at these, like, about 70 state fairs across America. And that has generated a whole lot of recipes, some of which are fairly weird, like, you know, spam ice cream. And one of the recipes, though, that isn't weird but is interesting, I mean, one of the more popular, I was talking to their registered dietitian about, you know, what recipes people most request. One of the most requested recipes is called spam French fry casserole. And it's made with spam, frozen French fries, corn flakes, and cream of chicken soup. And to me, it's like, you know, the kind of the whole processed food thing in one. But this is a current thing. This is a recipe that people want most now.
Wow is about all I can say. It takes my breath away.
Well, I mean, you know, I think a lot of people are under the impression, probably because, you know, if you read magazines, food magazines, or you read newspaper food sections, I think you think, you know, people are eating, you know, almond-encrusted swordfish and arugula right. and, you know, sun-dried tomatoes. And really, you know, to me, most food writing is more like fashion writing, which is, it's very interesting, but it's not something you would actually do in your own home. And really, I think, you know, most people, despite what you read, I mean, news and writers, for the most part, they're writing about unusual things. And most people are still eating, you know, Spam and Cheese Whiz and, you know, Kraft macaroni and cheese and all this great stuff.
My guest is Carolyn Wyman, author of Spam, a biography. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Carolyn Wyman, author of Spam, A History. She also co-writes the syndicated newspaper column Supermarket Sampler. I'd like you to describe the kind of food that you write about in your newspaper column Supermarket Sampler.
Well, the column reviews new products in the supermarket, so, you know, new processed foods in the supermarket. And I do it with a registered dietitian, so we sort of have a dialogue format. You know, so it'd be anything like the new, you know, if Cool Whip comes out with chocolate Cool Whip, we'll write about that. And because that's important, you know, here's like an icon. And we would talk about, for instance, Stouffer's. It's a whole new category of meal starters right now. And Stouffer's just came out with something called Skillet Sensations, Stouffer's Skillet Sensation. What it is basically is a bagged TV dinner, two servings. And you make it in a skillet and then serve it. And to me, of course, this what it is to me, it's for people who are ashamed of eating TV dinners. Because because really, I mean, it's much easier to just pop a TV dinner in. It's got its own little tray. You don't have to wash anything. And with this product, you have to dirty up a pan. And so, but you know, what that stems from is there is a lot of, and always has been since convenience foods came out, there's been a lot of guilt about among, you know, people who feel like they should be making home-cooked meals. And so all through the history of processed foods, they don't do as much as they can. I mean, like in this case, you know, they could just put it in trays and make it a lot easier. But they feel like, oh, people will feel better if they're actually dirtying a pan. They'll feel like they're cooking and, you know, being nurturing to their family. And in the same way, like with the cake mixes is a classic example. I mean, when cake mixes were first invented, they could put the dried egg in there and the dried milk. I mean, they didn't need people to add egg and oil. But they found when they did studies that people felt like they weren't really cooking, you know, if they didn't add those things.
What do your readers most want to know about? Do they ask you questions about specific foods? You know, has there been any one food lately that everybody's asking about?
Well, the readers who write tend to write in about their own personal nutritional concerns often. Or, I mean, there are certain products that you can tell are going to be big hits because people will talk to me a lot about them, like Lifesavers has these cream savers right now, which are basically, you know, like a creamy hard candy. And, you know, so they have a lot less fat than, like, if you actually had a candy bar with, you know, milk in it. But it's pretty much a lot more indulgent than a regular Lifesaver. And people are going crazy over this. I mean, it's sort of, in a way, though, it's like people went crazy over Snackwells when they first came out with those little devil food things because they were supposed to have, you know, be low in fat. And it's so incredibly trendy because, you know, now they've actually had to add back a lot of fat into the Snackwells line because people weren't buying it. I mean, I just went to the big supermarket industry convention in May, and there was not one new fat-free product in the place. And probably, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, it was probably 2/3 to 3/4 of the new products were fat-free. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, we're kind of fickle. You know, we're in fact, the trend right now is back to fat, basically. I mean, one of the products, new products that I'm most excited about is Sara Lee has some new individual, you know, slices of cheesecake with lots of, you know, junk on them, like, you know, chocolate and nuts and everything. And they've also got something they call cheesecake bites, and they're frozen and they're dipped in chocolate. I mean, for years now, Sara Lee, all they've come out with is, like, fat-free, lighter products, you know. And now they're finally waking up that this is what they should be doing.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Carolyn Wyman is the author of Spam, a biography. She co-writes the syndicated newspaper column Supermarket Sampler. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Kathy Wolf. Bob Purdick is our engineer. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Vikings. You can't have egg, bacon, spam, and sausage without the spam.
I don't like spam.
Shh, dear, don't cause a fuss. I'll have your spam. I love it. I'm having spam, 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 baked beans, spam, 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 and spam.
Spam, 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 spam,
spam. Baked beans are off.
Well, can I have her spam instead of the baked beans, then?
You mean spam, 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 spam,
spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam, spam,